I'm Amy Hall, and I hope you were looking for the hashtag STRAsk podcast, because that is what you have found today.
Is that where we're at?
Yes.
Is that what this is? I'm in the wrong place.
So, with me right now is Greg Kokel, and I'm going to ask Greg a question about Romans 14.
Okay.
You ready for that? Okay. So, here's a question from Rolf Anderson. I'm having trouble comprehending the end of Romans 14. Is this stating an act would be sinful to the Lord if we did not act in faith, and the same act would be ethical if we acted in faith? Could you please offer some examples other than food to help clarify this?
Huh. Yeah, let's read the passage. He's talking about eating meat sacrificed to idols and saying that, on the one hand, stronger Christians who realize that this is not really a problem should not be putting a stumbling block in the way of others that is causing them to sin into exercising a liberty they didn't believe was right to exercise, okay? On the other hand, those who are weaker in faith should not be judging the Christian's exercise of liberty. And Paul then says, we want you to pursue things, verse 19, which makes for peace and the building up of one another. Don't tear the work of God down for the sake of food. All things indeed are clean, but they are evil for the one who eats and gives offense. Move now into the passage in question. It's good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything by which your brother stumbles. Let me just pause for a moment there. Some people have construed stumbling as your brother thinking you're doing something you shouldn't be doing. I don't think that's what Paul means, because in another place, and maybe in this passage, there are two passages where he talks about this thing. He says, why should I be judged by the conscience of another? And we, in other words, we should follow our own consciences. But he says here, the faith which you have as your own conviction before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. Okay. But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he is eating not from faith, and whatever is not from faith is sin. I think the point here is that your conscience in some of these things, where you may be uncertain as to the moral quality of it, the permissibility of it, really, should be a guide. And Paul is warning here against wounding one's conscience, which can be wounded if you do something you think is wrong, even though it's not wrong, because you're violating your conscience. Now, this is not a relativistic point that Paul is making, because different people have different consciences. He's offering an objectivistic point that you should not harm your conscience, and different people's consciences are harmed by different things, some immoral, some not so, even though they think they are. And so the faith, he's saying, one should have is this confidence that what one is doing is not wrong. For example, maybe here's what the listener or the questioner was looking for. I do not think that the rule regarding Sabbath applies to New Testament Christians, the law and the Ten Commandments. In fact, almost no New Testament Christians, even those who believe in the idea as morally obligatory, actually practice it, because the Sabbath is sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. So Sabbatarians will, like Seventh-day Adventists, but certainly not most Protestants. Yet they still think there's an obligation of keeping Sunday as the Sabbath, and then they have various characterizations of what keeping that Sunday Sabbath looks like. And so you notice you have a variety of ideas about not only Sabbath observance, but when the Sabbath is and what qualifies as non-observance. Well, they can't all be right, obviously, because they're conflicting notions. And this, I think, is an area that is actually outside of the realm of moral obligation, because the Sabbath is part of the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law never applied as such to Gentiles. Qualification here, there are some things that are in the Mosaic Law that represent universal obligations and therefore apply to all people. not murdering, not lying, etc., etc. However, not the Sabbath. And the Sabbath isn't repeated in the New Testament as obligatory on Christians. Now, some people think it is. And some people think, and there was a time when playing sports on Sunday was a violation of the Sabbath, okay? Famously, Chariots of Fire illustrated that point with Olympic gold medalist, what's his name?
Eric Little?
Yeah, Eric Little. So what Paul is saying is, Eric, if you believe that you should, it's a violation of Sabbath to play sports on Sunday, don't do it. Now, by the way, it's not basic subtext here, but if you think it is, then the important thing is to protect your conscience. And therefore, if you don't have the faith to play sports on Sunday, essentially, that is the confidence that this is not wrong, then follow the dictates of your conscience supported by what faith you have. Again, he who doubts is condemned if he eats because he is eating not from faith, and whatever is not from faith is sin. This last phrase, whatever is not from faith is sin, and I'd like to hear your opinion on this, Amy. I'm not sure exactly how to extend that phrase to other things. Maybe it means that whatever you can't be confident doing before the Lord is sinful in virtue of your lack of confidence and violation of your conscience, even if the act itself may not actually be immoral. If that's what he means, I feel bad for people who are raised in really fundamentalist, legalistic environments, because their conscience now is weighed down by all kinds of moral obligations or lots of obligations they think are moral. And Paul's recommendation is, well, keep doing those until you get straightened out and your faith is stronger to realize what is sound and what isn't. But it does show, it just adds an additional burden to legalism, it seems to me, until people get a clear understanding of the gospel of grace.
And I think that's the approach Paul takes. He does say, you know, don't go against your conscience. If you think this is a sin, don't do it. But at the same time, he's trying to inform people's consciences all through his writings, mm-hmm. and especially something like Galatians, where he comes out against, you know, requiring people to follow the Mosaic law very strongly. And of course, at this time, this was a big deal because you have all of these Jewish believers who have been taught their whole life that this is what you do to please God. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, there are people who aren't doing that. Well, now how do you bring those people together, and how do you suddenly change from thinking, okay, now it's okay to eat this or to do this? And so I think that's what was going on here. So I agree with you with what you said about anything that's not from faith is sin. The problem here is if you think something is going against God and you do it, what are you saying? You are going against God in your conscience, even if what you're doing is not something that he has prohibited.
You're thinking you are willing to disobey, even though you may not, in fact, be disobeying.
Right. So what you're disobeying in that sense is you're not being obedient, mm-hmm. and according to what you think is obedience. And I think we get a kind of a clue about this earlier in the chapter, starting in verse 5. One person regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Each person must be fully convinced in his own mind. And now we come to, I think, the crux of the matter here. He who observes the day observes it for the Lord, and he who eats does so for the Lord. For he gives thanks to God, and he who eats not, for the Lord he does not eat, and gives thanks to God. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in both cases, they're doing what they think God wants them to do, and they're doing it out of obedience and to glorify God. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes the difference. So I don't think this applies to, and this is where it gets difficult. I think what you were saying about fundamentalism and
legalism
say somebody saying you can't watch TV ever. So I think that would be something that would maybe fall under this kind of thing, mm-hmm. where it's not like a straight moral principle. It's some kind of fence you've drawn around that, or some kind
of... Or your Christian community has drawn.
Yeah.
Your denomination is drawn, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, to protect you from excess, from actually falling into sin. But these fences then become issues of sin themselves in those communities. It's interesting, and I want to go back to what you mentioned a moment ago, Amy, and that is that Paul, on the one hand, is saying protect your conscience, but on the other hand, he's trying to educate the conscience properly. So back to verse 20. All things indeed are clean, but they are evil for the man who eats and gives offense. Okay, so he's saying when it comes to food, the food things, it's not a problem, whether meat sacrificed to idol or kashrut, which is the Jewish dietary laws, and Jesus addressed that as well, and would actually speak to the drinking thing, because he says whether it's not good to eat meat or drink wine or do anything by which your brother stumbles. Interestingly, I never heard this verse used to say that drinking wine is morally neutral, but it would have to be, because it's paralleled with eating meat. You know, if you do the morally neutral thing of eating meat, probably very few people would take exception with that, or the morally neutral thing of drinking wine, but your brother stumbles, then you're responsible for the stumbling. The sin is the stumbling, not the eating. And I clarified that what that meant. It's not just that the brother disagrees with you, but the brother is falling into sin by mimicking your habit that he thinks...
Without being convinced that
without
it's okay.
Without being convinced, right.
Is it the verse where he says they will be emboldened to eat in this section, or is that in the Corinthians?
Yeah, I don't recall.
Yeah, so the idea is that if somebody who doesn't know that it's okay sees you do it, thinks, oh, well, I'm just going to do that too, without thinking it's okay, well, now that's a sin, because he's not doing that for the Lord. Anything else on that, Greg?
Nope.
All right, let's go on to a question.
Makes me want to have a sandwich.
Let's go on to heaven, not Harvard. How do we respond to close friends or family when asked, how did you come to that conclusion? And they respond with, I feel it's true, as if that settles it. Is there a winsome way to get them to recognize feelings are not facts?
Well, first thing is to ask for more clarification. So... This takes us back to Columba One. So are you saying that a thing is true just because you have feelings about it? Or is it true because you have thought this through and have good reasons for it? There's a possibility when somebody says, I feel it's true, that they are not merely referring to a subjective emotion, but they're referring to a subjective intuition. Now, in both cases, subjective means it's within the subject, but emotions are valid, but they're not genuine guides to truth, because so many things could influence our emotions. Intuitions, though, and at least the way that we talk about them, are a different matter. You have rational intuitions that allows you to organize thinking. These are faculties that God has given us to make sense out of the world. And so there are laws of logic that people practice all the time, even if they don't know how to delineate them and don't know the fancy words to describe them. Why do they practice them? Because they are built in. They are built in to our human natures by God. We are made in the image of God. And so these are subjective awarenesses that some people may refer to as feelings because they're subjective. They're within the believer, but at the same time are not really emotions they're talking about, but a deeper, profound awarenesses they might have about things. So somebody might say, well, I think torturing babies for fun is wrong. Well, why do they think that? Well, I just feel that. Well, they may be referring to the awareness of their moral common sense that conveys to them the true notion that that's bad, not strictly speaking a feeling. So it might be that the feeling they're talking about is an experience of a deeper intuition that would be more reliable. This is why the first Columbo question is so important, and this is another place where that needs to be pressed a little bit more. Okay, explain to me what you mean by you feel this. Is it just a passing emotion, and so if you feel this, to feel the opposite tomorrow, then you're just as justified in believing the opposite? Be sure to offer these follow-up questions in a gracious manner, though, in a genuinely curious manner. I had a Q&A session the last weekend in San Antonio, and someone was role-playing a challenge that he'd had, and we were talking about subjective morality, and I was talking about there being objective morality. And so in the role-play, the person says, well, that's just your opinion. And so I asked him to explain what he meant by that, and he said, I mean, it's just your opinion. He simply merely repeated himself. I said, no, I heard you for the first time. When you say that this is just my opinion, what is it you're getting at? And so as I questioned him more, he finally came out, well, that you have no good reasons for your opinion. Oh, well, now we're down to something, because now if I could give you some good reasons, would you think that it is more than a mere opinion and is actually true, the thing that I'm saying? So notice how it starts out, well, in one sense, not so vague. A person has an opinion that this is just your opinion. But it is vague in terms of what they're getting at. What are you going to do with that? And this is why the person asked the question. And we entered into the role play because he didn't know what to do with somebody who said, well, that's just your opinion. He's stuck. The guy's trying to relativize everything he's saying. Well, this is where Columbo number one, drawing the person out to articulate this point more thoroughly, is critically important. And once he's able to get in touch with actually what he does mean, for example, well, you are giving an opinion for which there is no good reason, so it is a mere opinion, and I don't have to take it seriously. But until he does that, you don't have anything to work with, frankly. And this is why drawing people out with that question is so critical.
I can think of another way you might be able to help them see the problem with what they're saying. What you could ask is figure out whatever it is they're defending, and say, well, what if somebody said to you the opposite of that? They made the opposite claim, and you said, why do you think that's true? And they just said, well, I just feel it's true. What would you say to them?
Mm-hmm.
And I can guarantee you they'll start giving reasons.
Mm-hmm. That's right. What I did in this particular case is I asked, when he finally said, well, you don't have any good reason for this, and then it occurred to me, let's do the reversal you talked about. I said, let's say there was, you heard the screams of a baby next door whose mother was putting burning cigarettes into the baby's arm because she enjoyed listening to the baby scream. And you went over there and saw what was happening. And she said, and you said to her, that's terrible, barbaric, don't do that anymore. And she said to you, well, that's just your opinion. What would you say in return? And the person who's playing the role play went dead silent. Now, he was frustrated with the role play, I think, a little bit, because he didn't know what to say. But the reason he didn't know what to say is that question went right to the heart of the matter. Because the minute he says what it is obvious to say, everyone knows that this is wrong, and etc., then he realizes it's not just a matter of personal opinion. Some things aren't, you know. And so he thought I had, as a role player, he was stumped. But I said, you're stumped not because of the role play, but because of the nature of the questions. And my goal wasn't to embarrass or stump the person. My goal was to ask questions to help them to see the foolishness of the mere retort, that's just your opinion, that's just your opinion, that's just your opinion.
I think it's also helpful for them to think about the fact that there are a lot of people using this rationale for what they believe. I feel it's true. But if you can see that they can't all be right, maybe you can question yourself a little bit. Because if that person says, I feel it's true, and you are confident they're wrong, well, now you have to take a look at yourself, because maybe you're wrong, too. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not a solid way to come to your conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when somebody say, just to sum up, if somebody says, well, I feel it's true, ask them what they mean by that. And they, I guarantee they will be tempted to simply repeat their claim. Well, I feel it's true. So do you mean you have no good reason, you just have a feeling, and tomorrow you might have a different feeling, and therefore your opposite view will be just as true as your view is today? Because truth is always a matter of feelings. Now, that might be what they mean, but it might not be what they mean. And by sketching it out and asking them, at least now it gives you some way to go.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone, for sending us your questions. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.